Welcome to a special edition of Museum Chat Live. Our community is filled with diverse stories, and we recognize that our story begins with the indigenous peoples of this land. We acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on lands that have been inhabited by indigenous peoples for millennia, and we would like to honor the centuries of indigenous peoples who walked on Turtle Island before us. Well, it's 2024. With years behind us since we wrapped up the virtual museum lecture series, we've been able to share about half of the lectures with our wider audiences. We are thrilled to bring the rest of our hit lecture series to the podcast so that more of you can enjoy these fascinating stories and join in on the historical adventures. Of course, you can always catch the original lecture over on our YouTube channel. If you enjoy the lectures, our podcasts, and our programs, why not consider making a donation to the museum? Your donations help us to continue to provide the high quality and enjoyable programming that you have come to expect from us. We really appreciate any donation you're able to make. Visit our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca, or give us a call at 905-984-8880 to make a donation. Your donation makes a difference. On today's episode of VMLS via podcast, we're sharing a lecture about the Colored Corps and the construction of the Second Welland Canal with a lecture presented by yours truly, titled Upper Canada's Black Defenders Take on Niagara's Wild West. This lecture was originally presented on February 15th, 2022. Enjoy the lecture. Good evening, everyone. The St. Catharines Journal, July 7th, 1842. Our village for several days past has exhibited a scene of most shameful disorder and violence, which has not yet been quelled, although the authorities have been most active and vigilant and are still exerting themselves to put down the rioters and restore peace. That our readers may understand the nature of the proceedings which have taken place here, it is necessary to state that for several weeks past, hordes of Irish laborers from the state of New York, where all public works have been suspended, have been pouring into the village and its vicinity, together with a large number of newly arrived immigrants in search of employment on the contemplated improvements on the Welland Canal. All was proceeding apparently quiet enough until Monday morning, when a party of Corkians from this place repaired to the work and forcibly took possession of it by driving every Connaught man from the grounds and threatening them with instant death if they attempted to return, alleging as a reason for their own expulsion by the Connaughts from the St. Lawrence Canal Works. On Tuesday morning, a party of Connaughts, about 250 in number, armed with fowling pieces, rusty muskets, pistols, and shillelaghs, made a sudden eruption into the village to get to the great dismay of the inhabitants and terror of the few Corkians remaining in it, and who were soon fleeing in all directions through houses, yards, and over fences to escape the fury of their mad pursuers, which they fortunately accomplished, but not without two being seriously injured. On the morning of the arrival of troops, several of the Corkmen who had families in the village and believing that peace would be restored came in, but ventured too far from the protection of the rifles and were fallen upon by a numerous body of the other party. Two of them were nearly beaten to death. The rifles having compelled in self-defense to use the fatal steel, it was not, however, until the order was given to load with ball cartridges that the Corkmen relaxed their efforts to penetrate the village. David Thompson, magistrate of the Niagara District, had warned them to disperse, They did not keep this engagement, and it required the utmost exertion of the civil military authorities to prevent them from committing the most horrible excesses. A portion of Captain McDonald's Colored Corps have been called out until peace is restored, and are now patrolling in all directions to monitor the movements of these two factions. If you're just joining us a little late, that was the St. Catherine's Journal from July 7th, 1842. When we think of the Wild West, we usually think of a romanticized version from the movies and TV shows. A main street with saloon, cowboys with big hats and guns, women with fancy skirts and delicate demeanors in need of rescuing, all under the tension of an upcoming duel in the center of town. Lawlessness abounds. When we consider what it was like to live in St. Catharines in the 1830s and 1840s, we sometimes instead picture an idyllic landscape. Farms and farmsteads dot a mostly rural community. Mills quietly process agricultural product. Even the canal construction site is idyllic, thanks to some very nice drawings created from some hundred years after the unruly, chaotic scenery had faded away. While we don't have enough photographs from the period, historical record reveals the truth. St. Catharines' urban streets, rural farm fields, and most of all, canal construction sites were frequently troublesome and sometimes violent spaces. In the middle of a depression and under a government saddled with debt, the Welland Canal needed to be reconstructed. At a time when the severity of capitalism went unchecked and society was unable to support the most destitute, a hint of hope of employment saw the dramatic influx of approximately 5,000 desperate, impoverished, and starving Irish laborers into Niagara during the late 1830s and early 1840s. Their presence overwhelmed every aspect of life, and their destitution brought Niagara as close to a Wild West frontier as the local community could imagine or bear. Thrown into the middle of that Wild West group was a group of skilled Black soldiers incorporated into a militia unit known as the Colored Corps. Their numbers in Niagara varied between 1837 and 1851, but most records report their force at about 200 men in Niagara. Their task was to keep the peace among some 5,000 starving and destitute Irish laborers desperate for work and food. Tonight, I will follow their story as a thread through the chaotic, dramatic, and nearly unbelievable story of Niagara's Wild West. Before we begin tonight's lecture, I just want to mention that the stories tonight sometimes use language that is inappropriate and offensive, which I will describe most of the time rather than read directly from the record. Additionally, there will be many descriptions of violence, which some may find difficult. On another note, the historiography of this topic is quite interesting. In the histories of the Colored Corps, their Welland Canal service is usually a footnote or a final paragraph nearing the end of the narrative. In the histories of the Welland Canal construction, especially those focused on the unrest of construction laborers, the service of the Colored Corps is rarely mentioned, with very few examples. When the stories do converge, the Colored Corps contribution to peace is almost never credited to their skill as a militia unit, which in many other cases is well noted, but instead the prevalence of race relations and pitting one race against another is used to explain the de-escalation and to deter further conflict. Of course, this is not the case, as there were plenty of examples of their service during regular conflict, including in the Rebellion of 1837, for which they garnered high praise. It is likely the source material, including letters from officials and newspaper descriptions of the scenes of violence that have, over time and without proper analysis in that purview, led to the idea that their main function was, as Black men, to intimidate Irish laborers with the color of their skin and not their military skill. Not only has this failure of study reduced the Corps' actual contributions, but also withheld the agency and the historical recognition that the individual militiamen deserved and which their white counterparts and commanders received. Not that I expect this lecture to solve all historiographical issues, but with increased attention, I hope my hope tonight is that is to further consider some familiar local tales from an irregular perspective to stretch our imagination of these fascinating historical events. The military service of free and formerly enslaved Black people is widely recorded during the American Revolution, when the British promised emancipation to any who fought on their side. There were no segregated units at the time. However, there were plenty of examples of enslaved peoples joining the fight, including our own Richard Pierpoint, who joined the Butler's Rangers. Famously, Pierpoint was granted land in St. Catharines because of his service, during which he also won his freedom. Even though former Black slaves enjoyed greater freedom and legal protection under British law, Upper Canada maintained slavery with some restrictions introduced in 1793, and Pierpoint was only one of a handful of formerly enslaved people living amongst a population of approximately 4,000 enslaved people throughout British North America. As the War of 1812 approached, this kind of dichotomy is credited with the urgency with which many free and enslaved people of color volunteered to fight. The motivation to volunteer and fight is generally thought to have been directly related to their personal motivation to protect their freedom, which was only guaranteed under British rule. Thus, this double loyalty was seen today and at the time as particularly respectable, despite the racial prejudice they faced within their own companies from white commanders. Josiah Henson, a Black minister in Sandwich, which is in Windsor, organized a colored company, and he wrote, quote, "The colored men were willing to defend the government that had given them a home when they fled from slavery," end quote. Historians have since cited this fear of a return to slavery as the primary motivation to fight. However, that angle limits our understanding of the individual motivations and has rarely been expanded upon due to the lack of historical resources. More on some more historiographical resources a little later as we expand, and as it is a major question, of course, of the continued service of the Colored Corps during a time of local strife in the 1840s, but of generally peace between the between British North America and the United States. Of course, Pierpoint is widely credited with the idea of a petition to raise a troop of Black soldiers, since his actual petition was rejected by Major General Sir Isaac Brock. No record of why Pierpoint's proposal was rejected survives, although there are several probable explanations. Segregation within the pre-war militia was impractical due to the small and dispersed nature of the population of free colors, of free peoples of color. The influence of institutional racism in the military cannot be ignored. It was simply impossible for a person of color, despite their abilities or record of service, like Pierpoint, to hold commissions. However, the militia's poor response to the beginning of the War of 1812 in July in 1812 essentially prompted military leadership to reconsider. Pierpoint joined the Colored Corps in September of 1812, but was not selected to lead it. A white officer, Captain Robert Runchy, was selected. Generally considered a worthless, troublesome malcontent, his appointment and the appointment of his nephew and many others in the later iterations of the Colored Corps command who will meet tonight reflected the low status of Black units. While most of the white commanders throughout the history of the Colored Corps were unsatisfactory, Runchy was particularly despicable, as he was not above hiring his men out as domestic servants. In fact, a militia doctor formally complained that Runchy failed to fulfill a promise to supply a member of the company to act as his servant. The service of the First Colored Corps is well documented, well studied, well presented, and well recognized. So I won't get into the particulars of their battle experience, though it is important to note that they did fight at Queenston Heights, the Battle of Fort George, and had rear duty at the Battle of Stony Creek. After the Americans' withdrawal from Niagara in December of 1813, and due to a shortage of labor, the Colored Corps was essentially, there's lots of technicalities about this, attached to the Royal Engineers and were tasked with building Fort Mississauga at the mouth of the Niagara River. According to military historians, it was common for Blacks to take on artificer duties, even if it wasn't the original purpose of the unit, as they were considered good workers. The fort was completed in 1815, and then the Corps was formally dismissed from service in March. Unfortunately, they struggled to get paid, as most people did after the war, even as late as 1820. Richard Pierpoint's post-war experience is also well told. In fact, you can find a lovely History From Here video on our YouTube channel all about Pierpoint. And it was difficult. It was a difficult life indeed. Shortchanged by the government they had fought for, many Black veterans and their families struggled to eke out an existence clearing their wilderness. I hope by now that we all know the story of the Welland Canal. Mostly proceeds from the War of 1812, anyway, in the general way we tell the story. And with risk of sounding like a broken record, if you've been here on the lecture series since the beginning, I think we can all appreciate that the construction of each iteration of the Welland Canal was so all-encompassing in St. Catharines that everyone and everything was touched by it and connected to it. From workers and staff of the canal company to farmers and other community members throughout the little village that had popped up to support it. For more on the early Welland Canal, of course, its construction and troubles, please check out my lecture on the Welland Canal in 1830. Also available with a bit more analysis, I also released similar content as a blog series in November. As we journey to the 1840s and the construction of the second Welland Canal, there are a few important contextual elements that reveal the idea of a Wild West, along with the state of society and the tensions endured in St. Catharines, which quickly became a microcosm of international economic policy, the evolution of capitalism, the convergence of racism and racial prejudice due to immigration, and the complete lack of government programs, infrastructure, and general ability to ensure peace and order. The Welland Canal Company was hemorrhaging so much money in the mid-1830s that it only survived by a constant injection of cash from the legislature of Upper Canada. Year after year, the province loaned more and more money. Meanwhile, the canal itself continued to suffer shutdowns and was frequently unable to accommodate large shipments and vessels. The economy of the late 1830s was essentially in the bin. The rebellion of 1837 was particularly expensive, but the province of Upper Canada was already in huge amounts of debt itself and subjected to increased scrutiny from the imperial government in London, which actually instructed the lieutenant governor to withhold assent on money bills until given approval from the Queen. In fact, the purchase of the Welland Canal Company, as we can see here, was delayed from 1839 to 1841 because the imperial government requested the legislation be withheld by the lieutenant governor and later the governor general until money could be raised by public subscription to raise it. When eventually things settled down in 1841, as you can see here, a board of works chaired by Hamilton Hartley Killally took over operation and construction of the Welland Canal from the private Welland Canal Company. Despite the chaotic happenings in between 1837 and 1841, the board of the company and later the board of works had to get going with reconstruction of the canal and began widely advertising contracts for the project. While the rebellion of 1837 and resulting reorganization of our upper and lower provinces into the United Province of Canada in 1841 made things complicated at the provincial level, the international scene was made destitute by the Panic of 1837. I bet nobody thought I was going to talk about the Panic of 1837 in this lecture. Essentially, a run on the banks in New York touched off a severe depression that permanently canceled most of the canal building projects in New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and other northern and Midwestern states. Without a central bank in the United States at the time, thanks to President Andrew Jackson, so much capital had been sunk into speculative transportation projects that when the Bank of England, followed by banks in New York, raised their interest rates, it forced the price of cotton down, since everything was essentially tied to the price of cotton in the United States and throughout the world. The effects had massive reverberations. There was widespread panic, then poverty, hunger, and destitution. Half of all banks in the United States that year failed. Governments, including state governments, were paralyzed, and some even defaulted on their debts to British creditors. The result, which was to become most keenly felt here in St. Catharines, was the immediate unemployment of thousands upon thousands of poor, unskilled Irish laborers who had originally flocked to the canal projects in the United States for work. Guess where they came? Unregulated banks and unfettered capitalism are a well-documented legacy of President Andrew Jackson, but the inability of the government here to deal with the realities of the new capitalism of the 1840s are really brought to light in the construction of the Second Welland Canal. During the construction of the First Canal, and even the Erie and the Rideau Canals in the 1820s, contractors generally kept small firms of workers, and the canals hired as many contractors as they needed. These contractors would usually share the work and living expenses with their men, and often a common ethnic background. They most likely knew their workers by name. By providing food and shelter, they participated in some sort of exchange that was reciprocal and personal. By contrast, in the 1840s, the contractor was commonly a professional builder businessman living away from the canal site and its shanty towns. He probably had multiple contracts on various projects compared to his earlier predecessors, which took on contracts as temporary supplementary income to farming or other activities. Some contractors employed upwards of 2,000 workers, or on an even grander scale, some were branches of international firms. The larger contractors also subcontracted work, further distancing the employer from the employee. Additionally, the decision makers of the Board of Works were usually in Toronto and very far away from the actual conditions that the workers were living through. For example, when the Board of Works suspended the construction on the line in February 1843, Samuel Power, what we might call the superintending engineer, it's not really his title, but it's the lead engineer on the works, wrote to Thomas Begley, the secretary of the Board of Works. However easy it might be for those who are at a distance to speculate on the propriety of delaying the work until precise instructions may arrive, it is very difficult for me, surrounded by men infuriated by hunger, to persist in a course which must drive them to despair, end quote. Just remember that spending was pretty clamped down at this time. The new severity of capitalism on the ground in Niagara was difficult for those in charge to manage when the bureaucracy and government above them had effectively no ability to support or manage the situation. There were no social supports and barely any legislation regulating living conditions, working conditions, or employment standards. Between contractors and laborers were essentially on their own. Upper Canada lacked a system of public relief, which might have otherwise supported the laborers, even if they did have a system, which began to emerge slowly in response to the laborers on the canal in the 1840s. district councils rarely have the resources to run them to any significant level of aid. The suffering of the unemployed caught the attention of most, and in response to the lack of coordinated effort from the government itself, individuals like William Hamilton Merritt set up and led fundraising campaigns for the starving. He also held the Board of Works responsible that they should provide provisions in some way. Knowing that, however, government finances were as poor as they were, the best hope for the unemployed was not direct handouts, but employment on the canal. In this way, the Board of Works only sustained entrenchment of workers by keeping them impoverished and starving, but present and ready for the next labor contract. It is well documented that the large number of Irish laborers arriving in Niagara in the late 1830s and early 1840s held particularly strong factional identities, along with entrenched racial prejudices. Though conflict on the canal cannot always be tied to factional fights, these long-standing rivalries certainly fueled tensions. The Irish were not alone in their entrenched belief system. In fact, they fit right in. Society was generally, formally, and informally organized along strict racial boundaries. The poor, especially Catholic Irishmen, occupied a place of destitution, trouble, usually only available for hard labor, and they were usually only skilled at causing trouble, in the opinion of people at the time, not me. We'll see that opinion come through tonight. Not my opinion, sorry, again, the opinion of the sources come through. If you remember the lecture that Sarah Nixon, our public programmer, and I gave on the Howe Report, a series of interviews to ascertain the condition of refugee slaves conducted by Samuel Gridley Howe in 1863, Eliza Stevenson openly complained his rationale for hiring freedom seekers and refugees rather than the Irish. Quote, "I prefer people of color," that's my insert there, "to the Irish, as you can tell, or I would not employ them. I don't think there is as much crime among them as the Irish. Nothing like it," end quote. Unfortunately, the idea of racial or religious tension among Irishmen or between other members of the community was originally used by the media at the time to portray the Irish as drunken troublemakers. These narratives were used by the Board of Works to justify military action against them, rather than to quell troubles with economic supports and employment. Historians, unfortunately, took quite a long time realizing these nuances, and until recently, the narratives concerning these struggles almost always place the Irish at fault and perpetuate their dirtiness and undesirableness as poor, unworthy misfits. A great example of this is historian Ernest Green, who wrote his paper, quote, "Upper Canada Black Defenders" in 1931. Here's a quote from his paper. "To the natural tendency to the turbulence always found where large numbers of laborers are crowded together with scant comforts and no amusements except those offered by the saloon, were added in this case to the inciting influence of political and religious differences and further division of the Irishmen into two factions, known as the Cork and Connaught men." He later writes, quote, "To the Irish Navy, taught from infancy to hate everything that signified authority and power of the British government, and possessed of a supreme contempt for the African, it was the climax of humiliation to be kept within the bounds of law and good order by, quote, a blank in a red coat," end quote. He used the N-word there. The nuance that's been easily missed, since I should clarify, his use of the N-word was a quote within his quote. So it wasn't technically him, but just that was, just want to be super clear about that. The nuance that's been easily missed since Green wrote these mostly hateful and prejudicial words, is the severity of capitalism of which these groups were subjected to and forced by to act. While racism and racial and national prejudices are almost always present in primary source material, it's often not the actual case or center, actual cause or center of tension between groups. For example, the factional riots between the Irish were rarely caused by those actual political divides, but instead was merely the line drawn to provide workers to divide workers against themselves in competition for employment, resources, and food. Additionally, it's certain that Irish laborers, like the rest of society, held anti-Black prejudices, but also, as recorded, it was the military skill to which the Irish responded, not the color of their skin, not the color of the skin of the soldiers. Historians now agree that collective supports offered by a faction was not unlike a union, with membership based on ethnic origin. The Corkmen would take care of themselves and their families and would act when one group was subjected to poor conditions. The same goes for Connaughtmen. These clashes between... between these two groups, which were frequent between 1841 and 1843, were for each group and its membership to benefit economically and for them to be able to eat with employment, not to fight for the sake of old grievances. The lack of government support meant these fights went unchecked and escalated, with one riot leading into the next. The lack of primary sources from throughout the period really leave us at the mercy of the St. Catherine's Journal newspaper, which frequently over-dramatized conflict and blamed the Irish laborer, who was certainly very racist and always seemed to be drunk. Additionally, Green doesn't cite his poor and somewhat racist opinion of the Irish, which is really credited to his own feelings of race relations in the British Empire in 1931. Later, between 1843 and 1846, Irish Catholics, regardless of county origin, were more likely to band together, with very loose organization, against contractors and the Board of Works, and struck widely rather than fight against each other. In one instance where there were not enough jobs for either group, the Cork and Connaughtmen cooperated to ensure that no one took the few hundred jobs offered by the Board of Works. Quote, posters along the canal threatened, quote, death and vengeance to any who should dare to work until the employment was given to the whole, end quote. This loose organization was likely due to the influence and guidance of local priests who ministered to the laborers. We'll hear a bit more about the role of priests on the canal later. Regardless of the type of violence, whether riot between factions or violent strike against contractors or backyard brawls beating up police, the number of violent riots on the Welland Canal between 1840 and 1846 is shocking. In his book, Common Labor, Workers and Digging the North American Canals, 1780 to 1860, author Peter Way explains the correlation between the influx of unemployed laborers and violence. In the 1830s, there were 7 riots and 5 strikes on Canada's canals. In the 1840s, there were 47 riots and 26 strikes on Canada's canals. The majority of these were on the Welland Canal, though the lower St. Lawrence Canal projects also had their fair share. Though I admit, despite the motivation and causation of struggles at the worksite having for so long been mischaracterized, the language confirms the true sense of tension and conflict endured by laborers, contractors, engineers, the local population, and of course, the colored corps, tasked with keeping the peace. The large-scale migration from the United States into Canada meant that approximately 5,000 to 10,000 laborers had arrived on Canada's canals by 1842. The Welland Canal attracted the largest numbers, around 5,000. Excuse me. And considering the population of St. Catharines in 1845 was merely 3,500, the presence of these desperate laborers would have been obvious, felt permanent, and always on the edge of crime and violence. The Niagara District Council noted that the Welland Canal operated, quote, as a beacon light to the whole redundant and transient population of not only British America, but of the United States, end quote. Indeed, many laborers did find work, as there was need for manual, unskilled labor. Some historians even suggest that throughout the world at this time, the existence of huge numbers of easily exploitable labor actually delayed mechanization on the worksite and held these laborers to the most backbreaking elements of the work, including digging, hauling, and quarrying. Despite the heavy demand, there were still never enough jobs for the numbers who came. Of the 5,000 who were resident along the canal in January of 1844, over 3,000 of them could not find jobs. And those at work were only working a few days out of the month because of the weather. The employed and unemployed congregated on the banks of the canal. While living close to or on the work site with families, including children, was common for canal projects in the early 19th century. Samuel Power noted that they were particularly stuck in because, quote, the majority are so destitute that they are unable to go. The remainder are unwilling as there is not elsewhere any hope of employment, end quote. As a result, they squatted along the public works, throwing together shanties from usually stolen materials from local farmers and residents, including barn board, fence rails, and offcuts from local sawmills. They fed themselves by stealing from local merchants, including grocery and livestock, money, and along with fence rails for firewood. One of my favorite tales, dramatic tales, comes from the dramatic St. Catharines Journal on August 4th, 1842. Quote, on Monday last, a large number of canalers proceeded to the quarry that had just commenced, being opened by the contractors and drove away all the men employed there. Shortly after, they made their appearance in the village, having driven the workers home. It now appears that their object in coming here was that should they not be supplied with provisions, they would take them by force. And they have been as good as their word. Their first act of depredation was committed on Wednesday morning by plundering Mr. Barnett's store of 12 barrels of pork and 2 barrels of flour, which they distributed among some 70 shanties that had been built between the village and the mountain locks. In the afternoon, they marched back into the village carrying in their front on a pole, on a short piece of board, printed bread or work. They now openly declared as before that they had come for something to eat, and if it was not given, they would take it. Mr. Merritt remonstrated with them and pointed out the consequences that would certainly follow, such as an outrageous violation of law, and ordered them, as magistrate, to disperse peaceably, assuring them that at the same time that everything that could be done was then in progress for their relief. Mr. Merritt's efforts, however, were unavailing, and the mob replied by a well-understood Irish shout and a rush to the cellars under the store of Mr. Somerville, where they expected to find a large quantity of provisions. In this, they were disappointed, and the next shout and next rush found them in the flour mill of Mr. Merritt. Then off to John Middleburger and company. Then they proceeded to Henry Middleburger's mills and were also disappointed until they launched at the schooner Mariner, which was docked by a mill and had been discharging some cargo. They boarded and robbed Captain Gaskin of 13 barrels of pork and had it conveyed away by horse teams, which they pressed into their service. While these proceedings were going on, in the lower part of the village, another party of rioters with four carts made an attempt to rob the mill of Oliver Phelps, situated at the upper end, in which there was a considerable quantity of flour, which would have followed with the pork, were it not for the remonstrations of two gentlemen present, who persuaded them to desist, which they did, but with many threats and assurances that they would return the next day to accomplish their purpose. End quote. Such dramatic and perhaps exaggerated tales appear frequently in the journal, but also in the official Board of Works correspondence and in the reports from the Niagara District Council, that the substance of these tales must be accurate, even if the storytelling is a bit over the top, including the mentions of William Hamilton Merritt, a magistrate, and the local member of the legislature. Of course, because they were starving, a threat to the labor force, which was ever present on the canal. The laborers were also vulnerable to indebtedness to their contractors. While employed, they were paid sometimes, not all the time, using the truck system and inflated food prices at their company stores. Storekeepers, too, took advantage of the demand to raise prices, and some set up shops near or in shantytowns to take further advantage of the influx of desperate laborers. The combination of low pay, high debt, and high food prices had a dramatic impact when workers were laid off and returned immediately to starvation. The shantytowns themselves were places of destitution, camps of families with nothing, and with most structures housing 2 to 3 families. For example, of the 163 shanties built by laborers at Broad Creek on the Welland Canal Works, only 29 were actually single-family houses. These shanty towns, along with the canals, became close-knit, homogeneous working-class communities in which the bonds of living together reinforced and overlapped the bonds formed in the workplace. The laborers generally lived with their families in these communities. In the winter of 1844, a memo from Dr. Jarrow reports that some 1,300 canalers had brought 700 women and nearly 1,200 children to live along the Welland Canal between Port Dalhousie and Allenburg, with some 400 dwellings along the Thorold Road, which is Oakdale Avenue today, between St. Catharines and Meryton. That probably gives you a sense of how many people and the concentration that we're talking about. Right in the middle of all of that was the Colored Corps. When we left the Colored Corps some 400 years earlier in the lecture, the last segregated unit of Black militiamen was disbanded in 1815. It wasn't until 1837 that the rebellions of Upper Canada that a unit was raised in response to the security threats throughout the province. When Mackenzie began the rebellion, some believed that white militia may be unreliable if they sympathized with his cause. Formerly enslaved Black men, however, were undoubtedly loyal to the government, which had only a few years previously abolished slavery with the Emancipation Act, which took effect in August of 1834. There was, quote, no class of people who had more to lose by setting up a republic with the probable early absorption into the United States and a return to slavery than the Black population of Upper Canada, end quote. In St. Catharines, the newly raised Colored Corps was attached to the 1st Lincoln Militia, which was commanded by Colonel John Charles Clark, and captained by Captain James Sears, who had the permission of Clark and local magistrates to recruit Black men in prison, as well as not in prison, but those in prison who had been arrested in September of 1837 after having participated in a riot preventing the extradition of Solomon Mosby in Niagara. Extradition, by the way, was a more significant and scary threat to formerly enslaved peoples in Niagara than the rare illegal kidnapping, which must have further encouraged the Black population to once again take up arms to protect the laws which protected their own personal freedom. Right off the bat, the colored corps of the Lincoln Militia were one of the first to respond to Navy Island under the command of Sir Allan McNab and participated in liberating the island after the Caroline Affair. Following the rebellion of Upper Canada, the independent colored corps companies were amalgamated into a colored corps right across the province and retained on permanent duty at Niagara and Chatham. The immediate threat had subsided, but the tensions and distrust of the government remained high as the population was still dissatisfied with the failures of government highlighted by Mackenzie. Additionally, the United States was always noisy about invading Canada. In an attempt to maintain generally inexpensive and reliable control over the frontiers in southern Ontario, the Colored Corps was called up and garrisoned in 1839. The military wanted the militia to take on frontier duty, as it was too easy for regulars in the army to desert in the United States. For example, an Irish soldier from Ireland in the regular British Army could easily join his cousins across the border. The army reduced desertion in the United States to the United States by using Black militia instead of regulars by half. Aside from being stationed in these areas, the daily duties of the Colored Corps were really directed at road building. That is until 1840. In and around August 1840, a company of the Colored Corps was garrisoned along the Welland Canal at Port Robinson. Approximately 200 Black militiamen were commanded by Captain Alexander MacDonald. Their numbers were well sustained throughout the decade, as in a report from 1849, 9 years later, Dr. Augustus Jukes was appointed doctor to the Colored Corps, which still had a muster of 200. Luckily, and I mean luckily, the closest list to a muster roll we have is actually a sick list, which you can see now, or the medical stoppages of the Colored Corps Incorporated Militia at Port Robinson for March of 1849. This is a document signed by Dr. Richard King, surgeon, a colleague of Augustus Jukes. The list shows the periods of sickness, shorter periods likely due to colds or flus, and longer likely due to recurring symptoms of malaria, which plagued work sites as a constant nuisance, plagued the Colored Corps as well. Someone like George Baker, off sick for at least 31 days at a time of the report, is not uncommon. Unfortunately, this pay stoppage doesn't comment on the medical condition of the troops, so my guesses to their illnesses is really a guess based on what most people were sick with at the time. Unfortunately, a cross-reference of an available census data for 1851 and both the interviews of Benjamin Drew and Samuel Gridley Howe from the Refugee and the Howe Report did not unearth any trails that we could follow for these men. Though a great regret of most historians is not having more information about the individuals, and so I would like to read their names into the record as one small way to rectify the names of their colleagues being mostly lost to history. You can read along with me if you like. George Baker, John Ronalds, Thomas Lewis, Henry Johnston, James Archer, John Wigfail, James Riley, Francis Cleveland, William M. Jefferson, Eli Bird, George Hale, James Cleveland, Richard Howard, George Smith, George Johnson, John Furlong, Edward Penamime, Squire Bluford, Camille Woods, Henry Norris, George Johnson, and Henry Portman. I am eternally, oh, I forgot the second. That's the second part you can look at. I am eternally grateful to our friend Brian Nari, who I know who's on the lecture tonight, for sharing this document with me after I begged for it. I mentioned luck earlier because the acquisition of this document is really a story of luck and really goes to show how our access to primary resources, not all the time, but sometimes is based on luck. For example, we usually think that we have everything here at the museum, but there are so many primary source resource gaps that we have. So here's Brian's story. I'm just going to quote directly from his email to me. Sorry, Brian, if you didn't intend this to be read, but I'm going to read it. It's pretty great. This is super lucky. Quote, I came across the document when I lived in Toronto and I had wandered over to Kensington Market one day to shop. I stopped into a small antique junk store and the owner was going through a desk that he had just bought and was hauling the papers out of it, which he was going to toss into the gray box. I asked out of curiosity if I could see the papers and he sort of grumpily tossed them across the counter at me. My heart nearly stopped when I saw the Port Robinson document. When I asked him the price, he pulled a $20 figure out of the air, which I gladly paid. End quote. So thank you again, Brian, so much for paying that $20. I'm sure we all greatly appreciate it. I mentioned earlier that white commanders of the Colored Corps were generally unfit for service or tried to get out of their posting quickly. And this is a lot of the personal information that we have about the Colored Corps is really about their white commanders. Captain Alexander MacDonald himself was frequently drunk and spent more time in the local tavern at Port Robinson than actually in service. Once he, quote, presented himself in a state of drunkenness, indecently dressed, opposing and insulting the magistrates present in the presence of numerous canallers and challenging McFarland to walk out with him in public, in the public street to fight, end quote. Pretty good guy, commanding our Colored Corps. Another Thomas Runchie, thought to be the nephew of Robert Runchie, was considered to be grossly incompetent and a most unfit person for the situation he was placed in after he defrauded his soldiers of their pay and absconded to the United States. Finally, Alexander Stevens, was appointed an ensign in the Colored Company at Port Robinson in February of 1846. But by October of that same year, he was already seeking a commission elsewhere as it was, quote, a very unhealthy station. And he had, end quote, and he had hoped to return to the Royal Canadian Rifles, which would be much better for his military career. It is this environment then and under these conditions that August of 1842, for example, with the story that I began with and with other stories from August of 1842, that the Colored Corps was essentially caught in the middle between frequent face-offs with the laborers and protecting the canal works and the community from outright thievery. The Board of Works had established a police force of about 20 men sometime late in 1842, captained by John Wheeler. The police force was really intended to protect the canal works, locks and materials, tools, that kind of thing, along with policing for the skilled workers, including lock tenders and engineers. It was frequent, actually, but by their time was constantly, their time was constantly occupied in talking down strikers and potential rioters. We don't know how successful they were because we only have records of the explosions of fights. But when they weren't successful, they were easily and quickly outnumbered. In December of 1843, Captain Wheeler went to make an arrest at the worksite at Allenburg with his men. But when he arrived, he found the men armed. And when the culprit refused to comply, Captain Wheeler was shot in the hip. An express messenger was sent to Port Robinson for backup, and the Colored Corps responded. The report followed up as, quote, the Colored Corps were dressed in highly colorful uniform of the British Army. The workmen resented colored men wearing British uniforms, and this made matters worse. The officers were all white, but this did not satisfy them. The privates were chiefly runaway slaves who had escaped from the United States and were a fine lot of fellows. To the Irish, however, the sight of a black man wearing a red coat was so much more fuel added to the fire, for they utterly resented being governed by a militia made up of Africans whom they had always despised. The Irish laborers dropped their tools and started to march toward Port Robinson, but were met by the remainder of the colored corps, and 200 redcoats confronted them. It was only when Father McDonough arrived to negotiate the return to work did this standoff end. End quote. Aside from military intervention, the only solution to quelling impending riots and violence was the dramatic interruption of the clergy, as unsurprisingly, the clergy held special status among Irish Catholics. Another more dramatic record of this event states, quote, "The colored corps were drawn up across the road, with arms loaded and bayonets fixed. The mob were rolling towards them, and a bloody conflict seemed imminent. At the critical moment, Father McDonough, the fearless and militant priest, for whom the Canalers were held equal feelings of fear, affection, and admiration, galloped upon the scene of his famous black horse. Dismounting in front of the mob, he drew a line across the road with his riding crop, promising the ban of the church upon any man who dared to put his foot across it. The rioters paused. The priest sprang into the saddle and rode into their ranks, laying about them with his riding crop in no gentle manner. Diverted from its original object and having lost its momentum, the crowd dispersed without inflicting a casualty or sustaining more than a few bruised heads." End quote. It is likely, very likely, that this description is more legend than truth, and definitely a hyped up version of the accounts of poor Captain Wheeler who got shot in the hip. But it is no exaggeration, however, of the power of the local priests held over the workers. The Board of Works knew this power and kept priests on the payroll. In addition to a number of religious-based strategies, which had varying success, including taking an oath of peace in order to get work on the canal, they employed a number of priests to help stymie the necessity of military intervention. Father McDonough was not only priest to the laborers, but also an employee of the Board of Works, as I mentioned. The Reverend Dr. Lee was also on the payroll. Believe it or not, the board hired priests and paid them out of the police budget for the purpose of, quote, maintaining temperate habits, tranquility, and good order amongst the laborers on the canal, end quote. Priests regularly stood up for the workers to the board and the government, writing frequently for the need of aid, but they were also vital to keeping the peace. More often than not, the colored corps were on their own, though they never needed assistance in dispersing a crowd. The corps responded in both faction fights between laborers and in times when laborers accosted local residents. Often the laborers would steal weapons, including guns, swords, pikes, poles, pitchforks, and scythes. In one instance, they even took over a blacksmith shop and made their own weapons. Armed conflicts between factions could reduce the canal areas to virtual war zones for weeks on end, with 300 men constantly parading at least. In fact, many planned accidents in strikes and in violence would see canal works get disrupted and damaged and set back, planned accidents. Samuel Power tried to explain that to the Niagara District and to the Board of Works in 1843 that most of the time, quote, one riot is the parent of many others. For after their factional fight, the friends of the worsted party rally from all quarters to avenge the defeat, end quote. Oops. In one of the factional fights, the Colored Corps was called out to respond to the break to break up the fighting. In one source, a canal engineer recalls sending for the magistrates to bring in the military. Quote, the troops were sent for, but it was necessary to get civil authority to read the Riot Act before stern measures could be invoked. I wanted the most resolute magistrate in the Niagara Peninsula, so I sent for David Thompson. He came. The soldiers were drawn up in the face of a raging mob, and the Riot Act was duly read. It had no effect. A big red bearded fellow jumped in the air and shouted, quote, and this is quoted in the primary source, kill the blank, end quote. He used the N-word there. But Mr. Thompson stepped forward, pointed to the rioter, and said to the officer in charge, quote, be good enough to shoot me that fellow, end quote. The shot did not have to be fired, as the mob was then cowed, end quote. As with every military intervention on the canal, the Corps could only take action after a magistrate of the district council requested them to do so and generally read the Riot Act. Magistrates complained to the Niagara District Council and to the Governor General, that the canal engineers and police were too frequently calling on the military to intervene, and in some cases wouldn't even wait for the need to arise, so that when the Colored Corps arrived, there was little to be done. Regardless, it was the presence of the troops which gave the Riot Act and the magistrates any hope of control over the laborers. Indeed, it was always the intention that troops were not to be used to actually quell conflict on the canal, but more to influence peace by their general presence. Commanding officers rarely refused to attend the canal when requested, but frequently withdrew troops quickly once it had been established that disturbances were only expected and not actually in progress. It is likely due to Father McDonough's illness in July of 1849 that a group of 300 Irish Catholic laborers were unable to be quelled by his second, Father McMills, at the Battle of Slabtown on July 12, 1849. The story has been told so well and by so many sources, but the best and longest belongs to the report of our friend Hamilton Killalley, who replaced Samuel Power as chief engineer on the canal in 1846. He wrote to the Board of Works after these events, so I'll only read some selections of the report as it's very long. Quote, some days previous to the 12th, it would appear that there was an impression generally abroad that members of the Slabtown Orange Lodge would walk parade, and it is certain that the opposite party, the Catholics, had determined that they should not parade. Around 300 Catholics from across the Welland Canal Works came to St. Catherine's on the night of the 11th or the early morning of the 12th. They were openly carrying arms. The Orangemen, finding the number of 300 who had collected opposite them, decided not to parade, but instead to dine and conclude their evening in the tavern, Duff's Inn, in Centerville or Meryton. Father McMills exerted himself in urging the group who had gathered in St. Catherine's to go home and was successful at first, but they turned up the road that would likely take them to Slabtown. Likely the Thorold Road or Oakdale Avenue. On coming within a few hundred yards of the tavern, they decided to march by the house and give three cheers, one for the Queen, one for the Governor, and one for the Pope. It was particularly understood that no stones were to be thrown or any provocation given to the parties within. On drawing up before the house, and while three cheers were being given, one man fired a pistol, the ball from which went through the glass window of the tavern. The Orangemen divided, taking up positions in the tavern and adjoining barn on the other side of the road, and fired into the crowd, shooting six, killing two instantly. The crowd instantly dispersed in every direction. News of the shooting came directly to town. It took some time when the magistrate George Reichert responded. He put the Queen's rifles on alert, but did not send them out since the event had ended. To prevent the retaliation of that is apprehended and threatened, a part of the Colored Corps is now stationed in Slabtown, and I have also required Captain Wheeler and one of his men to quarter there. End quote. Of note, with regards to this story, there are several other versions which question who shot first and who was at fault. While participants were tried on both sides, there were essentially no legal repercussions of the events. Aside from these dramatic tales, during their garrison at Port Robinson between 1840 and 1850, the Colored Corps responded over 20 times to ongoing violence. They were likely called out more frequently than that, but as stated previously, would have found the scene peaceful and returned. On June 7th, 1850, the Governor General formally opened the enlarged and improved Welland Canal. The number of laborers had been decreasing regularly since 1846, since the work in building the second canal had begun nearly completed. Around 1845, 1846, and was mostly open for transit. Laborers moved on to settle in the community or in Upper Canada or returned to the United States. The presence of a standing military force was no longer needed, and the Colored Corps was formally disbanded in 1851. This wasn't the last time an all-Black unit would be considered, though it was the last time until the First World War that one would actually be formed. An idea to raise a Colored Corps or a Black unit was raised in response to the Trent Affair in late 1860 by Reverend Richard Ball, but as the issue blew over, they did not fight. Black soldiers in Niagara continued voluntary military service, and there are Black soldiers recorded fighting at the Fenian raids in 1866. The Colored Corps is well regarded today for their service during the War of 1812 and less famously during the rebellions of 1837. Their units were efficient, good soldiers and laborers, despite their poor reputation and regard from their white officers. Less known and considered is their service on the Welland Canal and the important part they played in managing peace along the canal construction site. It seems even more so than their white counterparts, the much smaller company of the Royal Canadian Rifles or the Queen's Rifles, depending on what source you're looking at. Black soldiers weren't used solely for their skills, but for their race. Most disappointing is the historiography of this narrative. As I mentioned in my introduction, the story I told tonight is a combination of two streams of history. The first is the history of the labor of the canal, and the second is the history of the Colored Corps. In either history, the service of Black soldiers on the canal is quite limited, if not ignored entirely. When their history is told, it's tied up in racial prejudices of the time and usually lacks analysis afforded to the strategies and actions of the Board of Works or the Irish laborers. Without raising these questions, the history of the Colored Corps along with the canal would be centered on their participation as racialized pawns in a greater capitalistic chess game against the racially fearful laborers, rather than the history of their actual military contribution to peacekeeping in our community in the 1840s. In a larger scale, it is evident that the Board of Works and the government both desperate and lacking in resources, did whatever they could and whatever they thought would work to quell violence, from moral and religious strategies to fundraising campaigns to troop suppression, but anything but direct financial intervention. Not that they had a choice, the province was broke. Whether the level of racism towards Black soldiers was dramatic in some of the other stories we heard tonight, the Board of Works strategically placed Black soldiers in a location where their mere presence was likely to intimidate. Unfortunately, this has allowed several historians the opportunity to undervalue the contributions of Black soldiers themselves. In fact, in many works, they are simply left out of the story or wrapped into the service of white troops. In other cases, their contributions are downplayed in favor of, in one case, more dramatic stories of the local priests of the Board of Works. However, they frequently responded, and in the face of racial vitriol from laborers, quietly did their duty. The lack of source material is also unhelpful, as we only ever hear about the Colored Corps from their white commanders or white authorities who called for their service and were highly critical. While controlling these populations was vital to contemplating the canal works, it also encouraged and entrenched racial tensions between national factions, religious denominations, and races. For example, while Black men were responsible for keeping the peace during the construction, evidence suggests none were actually hired on the canal works afterwards. J.W. Lindsay was interviewed in 1863 by Samuel Gridley Howe and revealed, quote, "I have been here nearly 30 years. I have never seen a scholar made here amongst the colored people. There are two railroads. There is a canal where there are about 300 hands employed, and you won't see a colored face at either of them. The white folks don't give them any chance at all," end quote. This led me finally to probe the material as to why a person of color would serve in the Colored Corps in this way. From the Revolutionary War through to the Rebellion of 1837, the members of the Colored Corps were praised as the most loyal soldiers in Upper Canada because of their profound and well-founded fear of being returned to slavery. Aside from keeping the peace generally in Niagara, a lack of immediate international threat made me question why they would continue to serve. As most refugee freedom seekers were locked out of skilled trades and other labor in St. Catharines, as J.W. Lindsay pointed out, there existed few other well-paying opportunities for Black men to take advantage of. Perhaps loyalty continued to play a part, but likely they served because it was the best available opportunity to them as Black men. Without the Colored Corps, or more generally, without a military presence, it is likely the canal construction would have dragged on, perhaps indefinitely. Both the Governor General and modern historians credit the suppression of labor conflict by the military for the peace that made it possible for the works to be completed. Truthfully, the government was wholly unprepared for the Wild West that Niagara became between 1840 and 1850. But it was the Colored Corps who kept the peace. Hi, it's Adrian again. We really hope you enjoyed the lecture. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us via our social media channels or at museum@stcatharines.ca. If you enjoy the lectures, our podcasts, and our programs, why not consider making a donation to the museum? Your donations help us to continue to provide the high quality and enjoyable programming that you have come to expect from us. We really appreciate any donation you're able to make. Visit our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca, or give us a call at 905-984-8880 to make a donation. Your donation makes a difference. Don't forget to subscribe to our social media channels, our blog, and our podcasts so you don't miss any of the historical fun. More information is available on our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca. Next time on VMLS via podcast, from Anatevka to St. Catharines, the early years of the spiritual home of the Jewish community. Thanks for listening. The Virtual Museum Lecture Series is presented by the St. Catharines Museum and Welland Canal Center.